This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because we create a virtual commons with our microphones this time of day all across North Dakota. Those real main streets that are the centerpieces of our communities are where we meet and greet each other. You know, tip a hat, share our news and opinions, talk about what's on our minds. And as the weather warms up, we might be thinking of the basis of our economy, besides the oil patch, is certainly agriculture, and that's a commodity business. And we're going to talk about an angle of that that is unique to our area as well with Jake Jorenstad. He is the CEO of Myriad Mobile, which is based in Fargo. Thanks for being with us, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a bit about yourself, your background. How did you get into the business you're in? What kind of training do you have?
Good question. So, grew up in Rolla, North Dakota. Small town up about 10 miles from Canada. Came to North Dakota State for computer engineering, which was a difficult degree for me. My mom loves it when I share my average GPA for the 4 years was 2.7. And so you can my math skills weren't there, but what I enjoy technology. I love it. And that was literally all the training I had, because at that point, about midway through college, I started Myriad.
Well, you have entrepreneurial skills then. So how
learned
did you get started in the application development business?
YouTube. So I learned about software, of course, at NDSU, but Android and iPhone were just becoming prominent in 2011 when we started. Really in 2010, I began playing around with these things, and I went on YouTube to learn, because that was the best place that I knew of to figure out how to do this yourself. And I did it in my dorm room. I showed my brother how to do it. And pretty soon, we're building mobile applications.
And we're going to talk about one mobile application in particular, Bushel, which has to do with basically marketing your commodity, I guess.
Yep.
But let's get a little more background. Myriad Mobile, how did it get started? How many people do you employ? And what's your mission, if you will?
Yeah, so Ryan Raguse and I, he's my co-founder. We started the company really in about 2011, mid-year, got going, and started off doing custom contracts for companies. So they'd say, hey, we need a mobile app. We'd hire Myriad to do it for us. By the time we both graduated, I had gotten married that fall, horrible GPA, as you heard, an A and two Ds my last semester. Didn't know if I was even going to be able to graduate, but we had 10, 15 part-time people at the same time working. So you can see why I was a little busy. And today, fast forward 6 years, 2018, we've got 60 people. 55 of them are downtown Fargo and 5 of them in Omaha.
So are you still in a period of growth?
Yeah, we're in a new period of growth. We've had these spurts and interesting situations over the last few years. 2014 was a rough year for us. 2015, 16 were a good year. 17 was a good year. Last year in 2017, we hired 25 people onto the team.
Give us a little more detail about what an app is. I mean, we all use them, but for myself and for a lot of our listeners, I suspect, what's the process of somebody coming to you and saying, Myriad Mobile, I've got something I want to do. What are the limitations? What are the opportunities?
Yeah, so we're able to take even just an idea of something that you have that you'd like to be built into a mobile application or on the web. Websites today, we call them web applications, where you go on, maybe you log into an account and you do something useful, not just read and view something on the web, but really do use it as an application. We build applications, so tools and useful things that can create value. And we take it from the idea. Sometimes company will come to us and say, hey, we think this can solve our problem. What do you think? And we take them through the whole process. We call it discovery, help them understand the problem better, understand what the possible solutions are. Help them with the design. We've got an incredible design team in-house, a lot of them trained here in Fargo-Moorhead at the different universities, and then an engineering team of almost 40. And so a lot of software guys and gals, and that's what we do, build it for them. And we deliver it on the App Store, onto a website, to their sales team, whatever tool it might be.
Typically, from start to finish, how long would this take?
Typical project is, you know, minimum 2 to 3 months, sometimes 6 months is kind of the average you see. We've done projects that have gone on for years as well, but different versions and iterations.
Do you ever actually sit in your office and not wait for them to come to you? I've got an idea for an application. I'm going to go sell this to somebody.
Yes, we did that a lot when we first started. Nobody knew to call us when we first started. We were college students. Nobody believed we could do it. It was a little bit probably difficult to trust a couple 21-year-olds, you know, just became of drinking age, and now you're supposed to pay us thousands of dollars to help you build something. So we had to come up with a lot of pitches, right? And so we learned over the years how to pitch a product, an idea. And we did that at first, and that's how we got our first contract. The first app we sold was $500. Today we sell apps for $50,000 all the time and sometimes $500,000.
Well, one of your recent apps, and Bushel, which is what we want to focus on, won a big award at the end of January. Tell us about that contest.
Yeah, so Farm Credit Services of America was running the Iowa Power Show. They're a big sponsor of it, and it's a huge event in Iowa, Des Moines. And there was a pitch contest, and we were one of, I think, six startup-type companies that were able to come and pitch in the competition about an egg service or a product inside agriculture for technology. And there was two awards. There was the People's Choice Award. I think it was a $5,000 award. And then there was the judges award for the overall win for $20,000. And although I would have liked to win the People's Choice Award, this cool company called Smart Egg that's building basically autonomous technology for the farm, let farmers use their tractors without being in them. They won the People's Choice Award, and we won the overall Judges Award for $20,000 prize from Farm Credit Services of America.
So you had to pitch this in front of an audience.
Yeah, there was farmers in the room, guys that we have, you know, customers of ours potentially were in the room, and then a panel of judges.
And how much time?
I had 4 minutes.
So we should mention here that you were in on the ground floor of 1 Million Cups,
yeah,
which is a weekly event in Fargo at the stage at Island Park where entrepreneurs, particularly in the tech end of interests, mm-hmm, get together, and a couple hundred at a time generally,
yeah,
and talk about ideas, share ideas. So did that help instruct you in your pitch?
Absolutely. 1 Million Cups rule is you get 6 minutes. And so I learned how to do this pitch through 1 Million Cups in Fargo. I've been at 1 Million Cups in Sioux Falls. I'm going to Bismarck next week. I'm pitching at 1 Million Cups in Bismarck about Bushel, talking about it. 6 minutes. So to 4 minutes, 2 minutes less, I just didn't play a video.
Well,
I still pitched it
the
same way.
Give us the elevator pitch version of Bushel. What is it? How does it work?
So Bushel is a service that your co-op or grain elevator can buy. And what it does is it provides a mobile app to the co-op that farmers can use for free. And what the farmers can do with it is they can log in with their phone number that they have on their account at the elevator, and they can see all of their scale tickets in real time. So you bring your truckload of grain in, you dump it off. Immediately, within just a couple minutes, you can pull your phone up and you can see the receipt, digital. No manual effort, just pushed to you. All of your contracts of grain you're doing throughout the year, you can look back in years past in history. You can see your prepaid balance, so you can see how much fertilizer, chemical, or seed you have available still. Basically, we think about it like we're solving the problem of a grower, a farmer in North Dakota or anywhere in the United States, to help them understand their revenue cycle and their expenses at their co-op. They don't have that today. It's all on paper. And for the first time, you can do it not just on the web but on your phone.
So what's the bottom line advantage?
Bottom line advantage, one is you're way more aware of your operation, your farm. You know what's going on. You know how much grain you're bringing in. A lot of guys are running more than one truck. How do you know how much corn you're bringing in on your contract if you have three or four guys doing it? Everybody's kind of doing spreadsheets and calling each other all the time. That just completely goes away. You know exactly what's going on with Bushel. And it helps you be informed about your account, and eventually you're going to be a better marketer of your grain.
So how many people are using this?
We just broke 8,000 users over the last year using the product. We see 3,000 to 4,000 every month coming on the product. These users are farmers for the most part, and they're checking prices of grain as the commodity market's down right now. It's really important to pay attention to what's happening and who's offering what, looking at your futures. But they're also checking if they've got to bring corn into Tharaldson down the road here, the ethanol plant. They're paying attention to when those things are due and when they've got to get those deliveries in. And then the co-ops are able to reach out to their growers through the app as well. So they can send messages and say, hey, we're shutting down early today, or hey, we're extending hours tonight because we need to get more corn in, or whatever it might be. That's all possible through the product.
So you need to sign up co-ops and
yes,
ethanol plants and elevators and stuff, right?
And there's about 4,000 of them in the country that we want to go after, and we've got about 30 of them on right now.
Okay, so the potential is quite large.
Yeah.
All right. So is this right now the biggest product Myriad Mobile has?
Absolutely. It's our only focused product that we own, that we are building ourselves, and it's going to be our only focus. This is we're going to have our services group that continues to build apps for companies like we do and have done in the last 6-7 years. And Bushel is going to be our new leading product that we're going to focus our growth on. We've got almost half our team working on it right now.
It would seem, though, that something like Bushel would have applications in other kinds of commodity industries.
Yeah, anything in commodities, you're talking about, you know, aggregate industry, you're talking about cement and, you know, even, you know, logging and stuff like that. If you've got trucks coming in and out and trying to manage the details of what's really going on in between basically a third party like a farmer and then the company who has the product to kind of bridge the gap, Bushel's doing that. And we're going to focus on ag, and that's our focus period. There's a lot of opportunity like this in other spaces that people could go and disrupt, and I'd love to help them do that if they want to pursue it.
If you go up on the website, this is Jake Jorenstad. He's the CEO of Myriad Mobile, and their website is Myriad, spelled the way it is, mobile with an E at the end, .com. There's lots of information up there about Bushel, about the business in general. But again, you have marketed this as something that is disrupting the ag industry. So give us the disruption factor here.
Yeah, well, first off, to go from paper to mobile, skipping everything in between is a huge jump forward. And we know it's working because our farmers love it. We have just some pretty incredible quotes we hear. You just made a farmer very happy, some guy told us the day they got the application, because they can finally see what's going on.
Because time is money, I tell
you. Time is money. Understanding your business helps you make better decisions. And today, that information is not available unless you're using a product like this. Nobody else has a product like this in the industry today. We have some pretty innovative stuff that we've done to make it possible to install on any company, any elevator in the country. We have a patent pending that Ryan wrote that is looking like a good possibility that we'll get it. We've never done a patent before. This is exciting.
I was going to say, how do you protect something like this? Because obviously, as it catches on, it catches attention too.
Yeah, we're getting some attention. So software's hard. You can't patent software. You can patent the process, and you can copyright the code. But if somebody looks at our product, says, I can do that, and they build it from scratch their own way, and it looks the same on the other end, we can't do anything about it. So it's all about speed to market, winning customers and keeping customers happy. That's what we have to do.
So how is that done? What kind of infrastructure does Bushel require?
Yeah, so we're up in Google Cloud on the software side. It's all running on Google Cloud. We have a team of 5 sales guys focused on Bushel fully, a team of 25 total working on Bushel inside Myriad today. So we've got 60, but 25 of them are working on Bushel. And so it's a pretty hefty effort. We've put just about $2 million of effort over the last 2 years building this. And we build it ourselves so that we can sell it at a subscription model per year to a co-op rather than having to make them pay the $2 million it cost us to build it, right? And so that's how we sell it.
But you don't have to have your own server farm. You're using Google, huh?
Yeah, we've got Google and Microsoft's a backup of ours, the Azure services. It's incredible what's possible in 2018 to scale a company. We don't have any people running around installing hard drives or dealing with computer hardware. We just tell it what to do, and Google takes care of it. It's pretty incredible.
And you're always tweaking, kind of improving the product?
Every
day. Is that the
idea? We've got a whole team of 10 people building new things for Bushel, adding on, for example, this summer, farmers going to be able to log into the app, which you only have to do that once a year, by the way. You can pull it up like Facebook. It's just, boom, it's right there, ready to go. You don't have to log in each time. They're going to be able to view their invoices when they're getting charged to purchase fertilizer, seed, et cetera. And then they're going to be able to pay their invoices right in the application. That's pretty incredible.
Well, besides the commodities, there are all kinds of inputs and outputs on a farm. So is it the potential for Bushel to really become the whole farm management platform?
We want to serve the co-op elevator first by reaching their farmer better in a more sort of personal way with a product like this that's right in front of them. But the ideal outcome is if we can make the co-op happy by making the farmer happy, then we're doing our job. We say, happy farmer, happy elevator. And so our end goal is to serve the farmer. They get to use it for free. Don't forget, as a farmer, if you're at that co-op, it's free. We don't think farmers need to be charged any more than they're already dealing with. When the commodity prices are down, guess who has to eat the difference? The farmer does. They can't change their expenses very easily. They have the hardest time. And so if we can give this to them for free through the co-op offering it, then I think we have a winning situation.
And you say you have a few dozen co-ops or industry people on board now, and the potential is in the thousands. So this could be quite lucrative.
This is a big opportunity. This is the biggest market opportunity we have ever pursued at the company's history. We've been around doing this for 6 or 7 years. It's probably the biggest one we've seen anybody pursue, even ones we've helped work on. So we're pretty excited about it. It's going to be taking this company to the next level.
Well, a lot of running a company is projecting yourself into the future. Where do you see this in a year?
You know, we think we'll have probably 80 people on team in the next year or so, year and a half.
How many clients?
We want to hit 100 by the end of the year with
that 30. That would be triple?
That would be triple with 30,000 farmers using the product by the end of the year, we think is possible.
Oh.
And next year, 50,000 or more.
Okay. So the growth potential is significant. Now, you also do other things at Myriad mm-hmm. Mobile besides Bushel. I understand you have projects with financial service organizations, educational institutions, and startups.
Yeah.
Give us some other examples of what you do.
Yeah. Good question. So we've got one of our customers is U.S. Bank. We work with a team here in Fargo and in Minneapolis doing some exciting work for them on the sales side, helping their teams use tools like iPads to empower their sales team and their efforts. We've worked with a lot of startups in town that kind of get funding either from investors or they go out and get funding through some programs like Innovate ND and some help from Emerging Prairie. So it's been fun to be a part of that ecosystem. Myself being an entrepreneur, it's fun to help those guys. And then you know, a lot of work with agriculture companies. We're working with everyone from some of the big irrigation companies in the country to groups like Cargill and others. We're working on all kinds of problems in ag, but Bushel is our only product that we came up with. We are helping solve a lot of other problems, though, and it's really fun to see, and we learn a lot. We're probably one of the leading software teams in the country in terms of expertise in agriculture at this point, just because being in Fargo, a lot of us grew up on the farms. And just the customers we have are ag. It's a big part of our business.
And you were a startup.
Yeah.
Now you're helping startups. Give us an example of what kind of are you getting too big for that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's always hard to maintain the balance of being able to take on generally smaller deals. But we do these things called discovery I mentioned earlier. We can do those for $5,000 or $10,000 and help plan out an entire product for a customer. Could be a startup. And if they have the money to go to the next level, maybe $50,000 or $100,000 is generally what we're seeing for a nice product that's sellable to the market. That if they want to go to that level with us, they can, and we're able to accommodate. So we've probably done work with 10 different startups in Fargo and in North Dakota, and it's fun to be supportive of what they're doing.
So you graduated from NDSU in 2011.
2010 at the end of the year, yep.
Okay.
No, sorry, 2012. I should say that right, 2012.
So you're pushing 30 now?
I'm 28, yeah.
Wow.
Ryan's 28 as well.
Jake Jorenstad is the CEO of Myriad Mobile. We've been talking about Bushel, one of the applications that they've developed. You can find out more at myriadmobile.com. Coming up next on Main Street, Harvest Public Media.
Minnesota State University Moorhead's Performing Arts Series presents The Good Lovelies, four-time winners of the Canadian Folk Music Award, performing sunny, upbeat songs that will help you beat the winter blues. Thursday, March 1st at 7:30 p.m. on the Gaty Stage on the MSUM campus. Details at mnstate.edu/perform.
Hey kids, do you have a story to tell? Enter it in the 2018 PBS Kids Writers Contest. We're looking for amazing original stories from writers in kindergarten through the third grade. So tap into your imagination, break out the crayons and magic markers, and start writing today. When you enter, you'll have the chance to win and see your story published online. First place winners in each grade level will receive prizes and have their stories featured on the Prairie Public website. Everyone who submits a story gets a certificate of achievement. Find the rules and entry forms along with a writer's guide to help you brainstorm and develop plots at prairiepublic.org. Deadline to submit your original story is Friday, March 23rd. The 2018 PBS Kids Writers Contest. Enter today.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Local or shipped long distances, organic or conventional, fresh fruits and vegetables are packed with vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients our bodies need. Farmers may try to grow foods with an eye to boosting their health factor and their marketing potential, but Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer says it's hard to measure their precise impact.
We've all heard that certain foods are higher in particular vitamins or minerals. Oranges are rich in vitamin C, for example. But are all oranges equally high in the scurvy-fighting vitamin?
There's going to be slight differences in the amount of vitamin C by the cultivar, the type of fruit that it is, where it's grown, how long it's been on the store shelf.
That's Iowa State University food science and human nutrition professor Ruth McDonald. She says the differences might even be significant, but that's not what nutritionists typically focus on.
We don't worry too much about that because it's really what you eat on a weekly basis that really makes the most impact, not one single nutrient in one piece of fruit at a time.
Also, she says it's really hard to make comparisons because there are so many variables on a farm. And there's not a lot of research money available to study nutritional variation among, say, oranges. Still, North Carolina State University's Chris Gunter, an extension horticulture specialist, says farmers and plant breeders can consider specific qualities of, say, a tomato variety.
They usually check for acidity, sugar content, soluble solids. Lycopene may be one.
Lycopene is an antioxidant that gives tomatoes their red color and is thought to have health benefits. But Gunter says neither farmers nor consumers are picking a tomato based on one thing.
People are very interested in, you know, does the whole fruit, consumption of this fruit impact my health as a consumer?
And he says farmers are considering that as they choose seeds. They pick varieties they expect will grow well in their soil with their climate conditions and their preferred fertilizers or pesticides. And they consider what their customers like, maybe a soft or a bright red or a juicy tomato.
It was more green in here, but Vicky got mad at that tomato. Bed.
It's a balance Jeff Hafner strives to achieve. He and his family run Early Morning Harvest, a diverse farm in Panora, Iowa. With produce, he adheres to one guiding principle.
If you don't think it looks right, throw it out. Chickens will eat it.
And those vegetables in the chickens' diet will contribute nutrients to the eggs they lay. Hafner says every aspect of the farm nurtures another.
The more nutrients in the system, the healthier the system's going to be, the healthier the products are going to be, and the more nutrient-dense the products are going to be.
His produce grows in an aquaponics greenhouse. Tanks of tilapia create water rich with beneficial bacteria. That circulates through produce crops, giving kale, lettuce, tomatoes, and cucumbers nutrients they need. It's a process he's had to learn and troubleshoot.
My first crop of lettuce in aquaponics was white because it was built around nitrogen. As the system matured, the crops were healthier.
He tests flours milled from his grain for protein content. But in general, his approach is to be transparent about how the food is grown and let consumers decide whether it meets their needs. The eggs, for example, tend to have dark yolks, which he says reflects the hen's varied and nutrient-rich diet. He doesn't know whether that makes the eggs healthier for people, but it's a reason customers come back.
That's one, and then just the farm fresh egg, it's usually the taste also.
Iowa State's Ruth McDonald says as important as farming practices can be, they're not the most efficient way to increase a food's healthfulness.
It's easier to add the nutrients to the food after the fact, and it's more consistent and it's more bioavailable.
That's why flour and milk are enriched or fortified with vitamins. But that doesn't mean you should skip the fruits and veggies. Just eat a variety. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plains Safaris in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
Coming up on Main Street, the gold medal U.S. men's curling team makes its triumphant return. And we'll hear a preview of the upcoming Fargo Film Festival. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A case now before the U.S. Supreme Court could make a difference in some North Dakota's election laws. The case is from Minnesota. A voter was not allowed to cast a ballot in a polling place because he wore a political button saying, "Please ID me," and a Tea Party T-shirt. The Minnesota law does not allow political symbols in polling places. North Dakota's law is similar to Minnesota's. John Arnold is North Dakota's director of elections.
Well, in state law, and it's been in state law for quite some time, no individual can wear a political badge, button, or other insignia within a polling place or within 100 feet of the entrance to the polling place.
Arnold says when he was working in local precincts, he can remember a few times where the law came into play.
And I do remember having some people come in. They were supporters of one of the candidates, and they had a candidate T-shirt on. And we just asked them politely to go turn their shirt on inside out or zip up their coat, and they did that, and there was no problem. We just hear that sort of thing from time to time, remove that political button from your coat, and it hasn't really been an issue in North Dakota.
Arnold says he's keeping an eye on the Supreme Court case because if the Minnesota law is found unconstitutional, it would affect North Dakota's law. School security will likely be on the agenda during next year's North Dakota legislative session. House Majority Leader Al Carlson of Fargo says he thinks it's unfortunate that proposals to add more security to schools failed in the past two sessions. He says other states are taking action.
It's been very controversial, and the school boards and the teachers and a lot of the organizations have said, no, we don't want somebody carrying a gun around our schools that isn't properly qualified. Well, if you look at what they're doing in Texas, if you look what they're doing in Utah, if you look what they're doing in Florida, they are making accommodations for making sure people are trained within the schools. Very rigid training and very detailed training, and they're actually paying these teachers extra for having that training and being competent in what they do.
Carlson says larger districts such as Fargo have done a good job in improving security in school buildings, but smaller districts don't have the money to do much. State Superintendent Kirsten Basler says she's been in talks with the Highway Patrol about offering office space in rural districts where they could do their routine paperwork and reports while forming a rapport with students and staff and helping to discourage any potential for violence. And hopes for the Grand Forks Freezeway may have to wait until next winter. Officials were planning to create a 400 to 600-yard long frozen path for ice skating in the Greenway this winter, but the project has been delayed because of extreme weather and equipment problems. Organizer Nick Jensen says there's a slight chance the freezeway could get going this winter, but odds don't look good.
Right now, when we still have some cold weather, we're doing some slow layering to see if that works in the same system, because basically we're just trying to see what's going to be the best way to make the freezeway work for next year.
With temps warming into the low 30s, Jensen says they are running out of time.
And we're trying technologies and trying a new system that hasn't been done anywhere else. And unfortunately for a lot of it, we've run into a lot more problems than we originally forecast. But I think anyone that's tried to make something, that's a lot of times what you find is, you know, there's new problems, so we've had to figure out different workarounds and then just build off of those to make sure that it's going to work for the future.
Jensen says he's disappointed with the outcome, but proud of the effort. The project received a $140,000 grant from the Knight Foundation. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The gold medal-winning U.S. men's curling team returned home to a hero's welcome last night in Duluth, Minnesota. It was sweet redemption for the U.S. team, which finished last and second to last in the last two Winter Olympics. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker reported for Morning Edition.
Northern Minnesota is curling country, and the gold medalists entered a packed ballroom following a bagpiper through a canopy of curling brooms held up by local players. The curlers sat on a stage along with two members of the U.S. Women's Olympic curling team. They seemed overwhelmed by the reception.
Well, first of all, I'm way more nervous now than I was to play for a gold medal.
John Landsteiner, when he's not curling, is an engineer in Duluth.
The Olympics are great and all, but this is way cooler than the Olympics right now.
Tyler George, who owns a liquor store in Duluth, says he felt a lot of responsibility representing Team USA.
The world's watching. You know, I mean, when we're playing at Worlds, we're playing in front of curling crowds. When we play at the Olympics, it's in front of everybody. And a lot of those people are now curling fans, you know, because of this. And
the Duluth Curling Club, where four out of the five team members are based, has been getting bombarded with phone calls.
My name is Zandy Zwiebel, and I curl with the Duluth Curling Club and love the club, love these guys. They have worked so hard to get here.
Kids are filling up youth leagues, including Zwiebel's 13-year-old.
The juniors are incredibly excited. I mean, my daughter has done really well. This has totally heightened her enthusiasm. I mean, she's like totally motivated.
And it's not just that they won, it's how the team won that has motivated so many people in Duluth and beyond. After the last Olympics, team captain John Schuster was cut by USA Curling. So he formed his own team, and they qualified again. On the brink of elimination again, they reeled off five consecutive victories. Schuster says this team was different.
We always knew that we had something special, and we thought that we had it in us to get up on a podium and maybe even on the top of a podium.
And he says to do it on the world's biggest stage was epic. For NPR News, I'm Dan Crocker in Duluth.
We have some additional curling notes to share. Olympic gold medal curler Joe Polo of Duluth attended Bemidji State University and the University of North Dakota, where he was also a member of an intramural ultimate frisbee team. And this week, Fargo will host fans of the National Curling Championships, which get underway Saturday at Shields Arena and run through next Saturday. The playing surface should be professional grade because Sean Olison of Fargo returned from South Korea, where he prepared the Olympic ice, and he'll be doing the same for the Nationals. Coming up, the Fargo Film Festival.
Prairie Public Education Services is hosting a series of free professional development workshops featuring area teachers, PBS resources, and best tech tips. Interactive sessions for every grade level and content area happening weekly. Join in person at the Prairie Public Station in Fargo or join virtually via webinar. Go to prairiepublic.education.org for more information and to sign up.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. One of the signs of the changing seasons is on the entertainment calendar. The Fargo Film Festival gets underway later in March. The festival, the biggest for a considerable distance around, will be headquartered at the iconic Fargo Theater, which has been a downtown landmark for 90 years. Prairie Pulse host John Harris talked with Fargo Film Festival director Emily Beck.
Emily, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the 18th annual Fargo Film Festival.
Oh, we are so excited. The 18th annual Fargo Film Festival will be coming up March 20th through the 24th. The cinema headquarters is the Fargo Theater downtown, but we do kind of spread out all over the downtown community with all of our different activities. And man, it is 5 days and nights of movies and parties and workshops and luncheon panels and lots of special guests attending. It is a blast. If you like movies, come and have fun with us.
Well, with all that said, let's try to walk through it here. Let's talk about how the festival has grown and, you know, how sort of the quality of films that have been entered throughout the years.
Yeah, you know, we've seen some pretty substantial growth in the last 18 years. When the festival first started, I think it was about 3 days or so and maybe about 30 films. Now we're five, you know, mornings, afternoons, nights, and we'll be showcasing 103 films this year, not counting the two-minute movie contest, which is another whole slate of films. So it's been growing every year incrementally. Our volunteer team has been growing. And every year we just try to take one step up. You know, how can we improve? How can we offer a better event for the community?
Well, with that said, can you talk about any guests you might have that's coming this year?
Absolutely. We are going to be having dozens of filmmakers and actors and producers and writers coming from all over the states. And then we have some folks joining us from the United Kingdom as well. There's an actor named Paul Bailey, who's a wonderful up-and-coming actor based in London. Paul attended the festival last year and had such a great time. He's coming back again. We will have actor Rich Sommer, whom folks might know from the television series Mad Men or the Netflix series Glow. So he's kind of blowing up right now. Rich will be coming back. His film will be featured on closing night. And actress Alison Becker, who people might recognize from Parks and Rec, along with a whole bunch of other television series and movie parts. Alison will also be coming in from L.A. To join us.
Well, so, I mean, you've got a lot of people. So how did Fargo get on the map with the festival?
You know, years of hard work. I'd like to think that it was just us continuing to work away so that when people did come, when actors or directors did come to our community to experience the festival, they had a great time. And then they shared it with their friends and professional circles back in L.A. or New York or London. So we've been able to grow that way, which has been great.
Well, you must be doing something right. That's we can give you credit for that. But can you tell us then about the pre-parties that you put on and where they're going to be?
Yeah, we like to party at the Fargo Film Festival. So every evening there's an evening showcase at 7 o'clock. And right before that showcase, there's a small party or social somewhere out in the community. So on Tuesday, opening night, it will be at the Hotel Donaldson. On Wednesday and Friday, we'll be at Prairie Den. On Thursday, it will be at the Plains Art Museum. And on Saturday night, we'll be at Sanctuary Events Center in Suite 670. Those parties run from 5:30 to about 6:45, and it is a wonderful way to interact with these special guests, learn more about them and their careers and their artistic experiences before going to watch some great movies. So
okay.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Let's go, I guess, to the talk about the Oscar caliber films that are entered this year.
Mm-hmm. So we always try to bring the very best in both short films and feature-length films to the film festival. This year we had several films that were on Academy Awards shortlists. One of our animated shorts actually was nominated for an Academy Award. It's called Negative Space. And it also won an award at the Fargo Film Festival, as you can imagine. So we're really proud to provide that caliber of film.
Yeah. Now, how do the jury chairs that you have, how do they go about finding these films throughout the year?
So it's two-part, really. Some of the films are just submitted. We have online submission platforms, and some filmmakers have just heard about the Fargo Film Festival, and they just submit on their own. The other part would be that our jury chairs do take an active approach to going out and learning about what other top-level film festivals are doing and trying to welcome that product to be entered into competition at the Fargo Film Festival. We never guarantee selection, even if they play at Cannes or, you know, Toronto. But we do welcome them into competition with the Fargo Film Festival.
Now, I say jury chair. What does that mean as relates to your theater?
Yes. So each category of the Fargo Film Festival has its own separate jury. So whether that's animation or documentary feature, they all have their own separate jury. A team of 9 to, say, 13 people who watch all the films submitted in that category. And then that jury decides what will make the cut and what will be excluded from the festival. A jury chair just heads the whole process up.
Yeah. Well, I know you had guests from last year, and of course, I understand those guests just seem to really enjoy, and in fact, coming back. You know, why is that? I mean, again, it's giving you credit and the whole crew that you have. Credit.
Yeah, it's the spirit of our community. I mean, I can't take any credit for that. It's the spirit, the family that's been created with the Fargo Film Festival volunteers and our audiences. And the warm welcome and embrace that our visiting artists receive when they come to Fargo, they kind of fall in love. Like I said, Paul Bailey's coming back from London. He made it a point to put it on his professional calendar so he could join us again because he fell in love with our community, had a blast. So that tells us that's the biggest compliment we could ever ask for, honestly.
Well, let's go back in history a little bit. You've been there 10 years, but in about the year 2000 or thereabouts, the festival got started. Can you tell us a little about the history?
Sure. I wasn't there at the time, but what I can say is that there were some people who were passionate about film in this community, including Ted Larson and Margie Bailey and Matt Olean from Prairie Public. Mm-hmm. And they got together, and there was a meeting of minds, and they decided, you know, our community needs a film festival. It's a major cultural event that takes place in cities all over the world, and Fargo needed that. So I'm so glad they made that decision. And we continue to reap the benefits from their hard work.
Yeah. Talk about the volunteers that you have at the festival. How could you put this on without volunteers?
Oh, absolutely not. No, they are the lifeblood of the Fargo Film Festival. It's a team, I want to say, of about 65 people, and they work year-round programming the film festival. We give them about 2 weeks off after every festival wraps. They get a little breather, but then it's hard to work for the next year. They do everything from selecting the films as volunteer jurors to helping plan events, parties, luncheon panels, you name it. They're making this thing happen.
When you say about 65, is it the same 65 every year, or how can people get involved?
Oh, yeah, our volunteer crew is continuously growing. If you're interested in volunteering, we accept new volunteers in the spring for that coming cycle. So you could certainly just reach out to me via email, or you could call the Fargo Theater in the spring, and we would get you on the team.
So what kinds of films typically get entered?
It's a wide variety. I think I mentioned it's all sorts of genres, so everything from animation to documentary to, narrative films to student work. And these are everything from micro-budget independent films that were maybe shot in Kansas somewhere, to films like, we have a feature called Bernard and Huey, which the entire cast are well-known, you know, professional Hollywood actors. So it's a little bit of everything at the Fargo.
Well, but really, when I look at this, typically they're filmmakers, not necessarily in the Hollywood mainstream, mm-hmm. and they may have other jobs that pay yes. the bills, so it's really a wide range that you have.
Oh, it really is, and a lot of these end up being passion projects for these artists that maybe are in the Hollywood mainstream, you know, some of them, but this is the story that they really care about, so they get it done on an independent basis, and that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I understand kind of in conjunction with the festival, you had a Sean Astin event in yeah. September. Can you tell me about that and how that went?
Yeah, so we've always dreamed of expanding the film festival beyond just that one week in March by holding satellite events in the community. And we were fortunate enough to partner with Project Hero in town to bring actor Sean Astin in for an evening with Sean Astin. And it was just, you know, he's an iconic actor, and we had him on stage having a conversation about his career. We showed clips from his films. And then he was kind enough to do a meet and greet with his fans and take some photos. We heard the most wonderful feedback from that. Everything from little kids to big kids like me, just being so excited to meet this icon. And hopefully we'll be able to continue having these satellite events throughout the year to keep the Fargo Film Festival presence up year round.
Well, and of course the Fargo Film Festival, now we're going to kind of convert over to the theater itself. And, you know, could you do it without the theater? Or does that play hand in hand?
They absolutely do, because the Fargo Film Festival is actually the Fargo Theater's largest annual fundraiser. So, of course, the Fargo Film Festival needs a venue, which is the Fargo Theater, and then it supports the Fargo Theater by generating funds that help keep us going for many months.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Fargo Theater a little bit more. Obviously, it's been renovated. You've added a second theater there. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the theater and the history of that.
Well, the Fargo Theater was built in 1926, and it has basically been in operation ever since. In 2009, we added Theater 2, so now we're a duplex cinema offering, you know, films and live events in both auditoriums on a regular basis. We offer new release, independent, and foreign films. We also have concerts and local performing arts groups performing on our stage. And we do specialty series as well. So we'll have a kids' flick series offering affordable movie entertainment for families. We'll also do a classic film series where once a month we show something like Casablanca or Gone with the Wind up on the big screen to give people that experience as well. So we do all sorts of stuff.
There really seems to be, because you say a lot of independent movies, but and you mentioned some of the other events, but I mean, did you always have other events, or has the second theater allowed you to do just that much more?
Well, it's a little bit of both. So when the Fargo Theater opened in 1926, we were a cinema and a vaudeville theater. So live entertainment has always been in the mix at the Fargo Theater, but the addition of Theater 2 has allowed us to expand that live event programming significantly, because it means we don't have to interrupt our film programming to bring in a great concert or a great performance. So that little theater is the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, it really is, and it does help a lot. But, you know, how do people, though, become members or get involved with the Fargo Theater?
Yeah, so the Fargo Theater is a nonprofit organization, and we're able to thrive for nearly 92 years now because we get a lot of support from the community. And membership is a wonderful way to support the Fargo Theater. As I'm sure you folks know very well, membership programs are wonderful because you're giving to an organization, and then we're also able to give a little bit back to you with special perks and tickets and discounts. And you're able to sign up for our membership program on fargotheater.org. We also have a sustaining option for as little as $5 a month, so we can work with almost any budget if you're interested in supporting our theater.
Yeah. So what is your vision? What are the goals for the theater for the next, well, I don't know, 3, 5, 10 years?
Well, my biggest goal would be to continue growing the Fargo Film Festival as our largest fundraiser, both the week itself and then expanding those satellite events, like I said. We recently just installed all new seats in Theater 2. That was a long-term project for us, so we're still kind of celebrating from having that accomplished. And we also just recently purchased Theater 2 with a contract deed with the Kilbourne Group. So we got a couple of those big long-term goals checked off the list, and now it's all about growing and expanding our programming and our offerings for the community.
Yeah. Okay. Again, now let's go back, I guess, to the Fargo Film Festival. You know, with that, you mentioned it, you're growing it, but what will it take? What are the things that you have to do to grow it? I mean, is it just more people, more... Yeah, tell me about that.
Yeah, so it's everything from more submissions, more films being submitted into competition. Hopefully, maybe we can expand the number of days the festival runs, add venues all over the city, hopefully. You know, for some large film festivals, they literally take over the entire city. We think we're pretty fancy just to kind of taking over downtown, but it would be great someday to see our festival spread all over Fargo with parties and activities and educational opportunities. And lots and lots and lots of movies. So.
Yeah, well, because the way I look at it, I mean, it seems like you reach a point where you just can't do any more, but that you don't have a ceiling yet. It doesn't sound like
not yet. We'll know when we get there, I think. But we're all pretty positive about growth moving forward.
There are seven winning films, and in seven different categories. Can you tell me a little bit about some of them?
Oh, absolutely. It is a wonderful, diverse collection of films that represent our winners this year. We have an animated short from Don Hertzfeldt, who is a relatively young man, but already an icon in the animation community. So we're very honored to show World of Tomorrow, Episode 2, The Burden of Other People's Thoughts is the name of his film. And we're just so proud to include that in our programming. Our narrative feature winner is a film called Sami Blood, which tells the story of an indigenous Swedish girl, a Sami reindeer herder, who is then taken from her home and forced into a boarding school, and it follows her journey. It's fascinating. So, yeah, there's a little bit of something for everybody, from drama to comedy to animation, and I'm so proud of the work our volunteers did selecting these films. They are top-notch.
Now, you said you give them 2 weeks off. And you'll start for next year. I mean, is it really that? So it takes that much time to put all this together and bring it to a culmination of 5 days for the festival?
It really, truly does. And these people are incredibly dedicated. After the little breather, we get to work selecting leaders for the next year. And then those folks are assigned to their juries and they get to work finding films and starting to screen films. We had over 300 films submitted into competition this year. So as you can imagine, that's a lot of screen time. That's a lot of films to watch. And so a really, really year-round effort.
Okay. Well, again, if people want more information either about the Fargo Theater or the Fargo Film Festival, and of course that's what we're talking about mostly here today, where can they go? Who can they contact?
Please visit fargofilmfestival.com for information on the entire festival, whether it be tickets or screening schedule or special guests. Or a workshop that we have in the works. For anything on the Fargo Theater, that'll be fargotheater.org.
Now, you mentioned tickets. Do you have to buy a ticket for all 5 days? Can you go for one day?
Oh, we try to offer a little something for everyone. Everything from a single session ticket. So let's say maybe you could just attend one afternoon or one evening. You can buy an individual session ticket. Or we do have more comprehensive passes. We have a lot of folks who like to take the week off of work and come down and make a week of it. So we offer those passes that include everything as well.
Well, Emily, we thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Prairie Pulse host John Harris talking with Fargo Film Festival director Emily Beck. You can watch this interview and see some film clips on our television service this Friday at 7:30 Central. Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Parents, students, decision makers, everybody's a stakeholder in the success of education in North Dakota.
And that is why Prairie Public Education Services has teamed up with North Dakota United, the North Dakota Department for Public Instruction, and innovation expert Ted Dintersmith for the weekly Cutting Ed podcast. Hosted by Tom Gerhart, the Cutting Ed explores education innovations in our state. You can find the Cutting Ed wherever you get your podcasts or at ndunited.org/thecuttinged.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 28th. North Dakota remembers World War I. In September of 1917, the North Dakota regiments left the state to the training camps in the east. They found comfort there in the YMCA huts in the large cantonments. These huts provided an escape from the rigors of military life for the homesick boys. Many had never been away from their families before. By the end of January of 1918, the 1st and 2nd North Dakota regiments were on the battlefields of France, and most of their companies had been stripped and transferred to other regiments. This eroded the camaraderie and support of longtime friends. E.H. Tostevin rode home from a YMCA hut somewhere in France, near enough to the front to hear the guns boom. He said his surroundings brought back the memories of the old town hall, with the air reeking with tobacco smoke and other odors. Frayed bunting, calendars, highly colored posters all helped to add a little cheer. The YMCA hut was a wooden building, 50 by 100 feet, with 48 tables lining the walls, sitting six at a table. Cheery open fireplaces, books, magazines, and phonographs provided refuge away from the front. Tostevin wrote that a shadow of gloom spread over the North Dakota boys from the loss of two of their comrades, but that the men were forgetting their hardships and the gnawing hunger for home, as there was music in the air. The North Dakota 164th Orchestra cut loose with popular hits from a year ago, music that the boys remembered. It brought back fond memories of when they danced back home with their own special girl, and yet Tostevin said that it seemed to soothe rather than augment the longing for when peace shall send them back to their loved ones. He recalled a night when there was no special program, so they instituted what the Tommies, or British troops, called a sing. They passed around sheets of paper containing song lyrics, and the orchestra provided the music. For 2 hours, almost 500 soldiers sang old favorites, such as Onward Christian Soldiers or Rock of Ages. So popular was music at the front that Brigadier General Hunter Liggett, commander of the I Corps of the American Expeditionary Force, refused to allow the North Dakota 2nd Regimental Band to be split up, stating that the band is worth $1 million to the United States Army. But to the North Dakota soldiers in the YMCA huts at the front, it was worth more than that. It provided a vital link to home. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Ray Rivera was DJing the night a gunman opened fire at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida in 2016.
There's quite a few songs that, you know, I used to play there exclusively, and I play every once in a while now that, you know, when I hear it, it kind of brings me back to that day.
49 people were killed in the Pulse nightclub shooting. Now the wife of the shooter stands trial, accused of knowing her husband's plan of attack. That's on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll hear about Think and Drink. It's an effort from the North Dakota Humanities Council to get people together for lively, intelligent conversation over a beer. The council hosts these discussions in Bismarck and Minot. And on Thursday, we'll talk with Kayla Schmidt, the Think and Drink Program Coordinator, and Ellie Shockley with Bismarck State College. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.